The views and opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of Natural Bridges Media or KSQD's staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
KSQD thanks Sustainable Systems Research Foundation for supporting Sustainability Now. SSRF provides education, research, and advocacy for regional environmental quality and sustainability-related problems and solutions. For information, visit SustainableSystemsFoundation.org, and thank you, SSRF, for supporting community radio, KSQD 90.7 FM.
Well, good evening. It's every other Sunday again, and welcome to Sustainability Now, a biweekly program focused on environment and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz, and today my guest is Robert Staton, a local physicist, author, teacher, programmer, inventor, technical writer, typesetter, bread baker, and worm farmer, with degrees in physics and science communication, but not in politics or economics. Staton is author of Power Shift, From Fossil Energy to Dynamic Solar Power, and his most recent book is Solar Dividends, How Solar Energy Can Generate a Basic Income for Everyone on Earth, which is what we're going to talk about today. But before I do that, I just want to read some encomiums from the back of the book. Bill McKibben says, a thought-provoking idea if there ever was one. Well, you'll have to hear the idea, of course. Dennis Hayes, some of you may remember Dennis. Robert Staton's new book makes a compelling argument that a solar revolution can lead to a fairer, more equitable society. And our very own Rachel Goodman says, this book could be a game changer for our beleaguered planet. So let's get started with some questions. And I want to tell you, as a one-time physicist turned social scientist and all-around skeptic, I'm especially interested in the political and economic arrangements that would be required for your project. So we do have somebody here who knows something about politics or economics. But let's get started with the basics. So tell us about your background, what you do when you're not writing books and baking bread, and how you got into this business.
Thanks, Ronnie. I'm glad to be here. I came to UCSC as a graduate student in physics. During the first solar boom during the Carter administration, I immediately latched onto the idea of solar energy to save the world from fossil fuels and global warming. And with my physics background, I found I could explain energy to the average person. I taught solar energy at Cabrillo College and UCSC for many years. In 1997, my wife and I finally built our solar home, powered by an off-grid solar array. I make my living as a computer consultant, but I've been a solar subversive all my adult life. My first book, Power Shift, described how the world can transition to 100% solar-powered energy systems and why we should do so. My new book, Solar Dividends, grew out of that first book and provides a new and, I hope, interesting way for how to make that happen.
Okay, let's start with some technical definitions. So that our audience is more or less clear about what we're talking about. How much electricity and energy is 1 kilowatt hour? And how much power is 1 kilowatt? I know my students have a difficult time differentiating between the two. And I'm not trying to put you in a spot.
No problem.
But you know, we're going to be throwing these numbers around.
Sure.
And it seems to me that's really important. Maybe you can give some examples.
Sure, I do.
So the audience has a sense.
No problem. A kilowatt, of course, is 1,000 watts, and a watt is a unit of power. And power is the rate at which energy flows, sort of like a speedometer on your car. So a 10-watt LED bulb uses, 10 watts when it's on. So 100 of them would use a kilowatt. A toaster or a microwave actually uses a whole kilowatt themselves while it is running. A kilowatt hour, on the other hand, is a unit of energy. 1 kilowatt of power running for 1 hour. If you ran your microwave at full power for an hour, that would use a kilowatt hour. A kilowatt hour is actually a lot of energy. For example, this is my favorite example, actually. If properly used, your 1 kilowatt hour could lift the Statue of Liberty 5 feet into the air. And it would cost you all of 25 cents in New York City.
For how long?
It would lift it that high. It would provide enough energy to lift the elevator.
As long as you had something underneath.
Right. If you had a winch set up to lift the Statue of Liberty, and you needed to power that winch, you could lift it up for 1 kilowatt hour. So that tells you how much energy is in a kilowatt hour. It's a lot. So another example is an electric car can go about 4 miles on a kilowatt hour.
One of the things I know that we're familiar with is that at rest, each of us is putting out power at the rate of 100 watts. And so if you remember incandescent bulbs, that's about equivalent to a bright incandescent bulb.
Yeah.
Right? But it would take 10 hours to generate
a kilowatt hour of
energy, right? Energy equivalent, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I hope that, you know, makes that particular thing clear. So let's, can you provide us then with a general overview of the proposal you're presenting in solar dividends?
Sure. My idea is to use solar energy to eliminate poverty. The idea itself is straightforward. We set up solar panels for each person on solar farms, sell the electricity the panels generate, and deliver the money as solar dividends to the person as their basic income. It builds on the idea of unconditional basic incomes, which Andrew Yang has promoted in his presidential campaign. In such a program, people receive a basic amount of money every month, unconditionally, to keep them out of poverty. This is becoming more important as jobs disappear into robotics and artificial intelligence. But most basic income plans are paid for by raising taxes, and that's where they meet a lot of resistance. Instead, my plan generates a valuable commodity, electricity, and pays for that, and sells that to pay for the program. I think this will be a more acceptable way to generate basic incomes. In my plan, we don't give people solar panels because many people can't use them directly because they don't own their roof and because they move. The panels are instead designed to set up on a permanent location in a cooperative-run solar farm, and the electricity that they generate is sold into the grid. The panels pay for themselves through the money they earn by generating electricity. After payoff, the money becomes the monthly solar dividend. The money itself won't run out because the panels are maintained and replaced as needed. And we don't have to wait for an international treaty to start this program because every country receives enough raw solar energy to set up their own program. So by investing in productive solar panels and adjusting how we price electricity, we can actually generate basic incomes for everyone without new taxes. So eliminating poverty becomes a whole new reason to build a lot of solar. If climate change doesn't motivate you, perhaps providing economic security for your children and grandchildren will. We could call this a poverty prevention program, with an added side benefit of halting climate change. Even climate change deniers could get on board with that. In the future scenario I describe in my book, each newborn is granted a 10-kilowatt array at birth. The panels are installed in their name, but they don't actually own them, just the right to the electricity revenue. The first few years of operation pay off the panels, and then the electricity money goes into a solar escrow account. At age 18, they are given the escrow funds as a lump sum to start their adult life, and the solar revenue starts flowing directly into their bank account as their monthly basic incomes. In this way, we eliminate poverty before it starts. Of course, we won't prevent people from falling into poverty if they misuse their income, but society at least gives everyone a good chance to thrive.
Yeah, the idea of the basic income is an intriguing one. I think you mentioned, and I sort of remembered Richard Nixon even talking about this, you know, 50 years ago now.
Yeah, he did. Milton Friedman, a conservative economist, proposed a sort of negative income tax, which would be a way to bring everyone up to speed. A minimum basic income is what it would be.
Right. But it's always seen as some kind of grab.
Well, it's always seen as a way for poor people to sponge off of the rest of society.
Yeah.
And not working people who are working may object to that.
Yeah. Let's see. How much space would this take up? Okay. This is, of course, a question that comes up. Is there enough open space to accommodate the solar panels required to, you know, for 10 billion people, since that's what we're going to be talking about?
Yeah. My program is based on photovoltaic panels, the solar panels that you see everywhere. They convert sunlight directly to electricity, quietly and without any moving parts, which means that they can be put just about anywhere, anywhere that's sun, that is. And they don't have to consume the land if you can operate underneath them, as on a roof or a parking lot. They can even be compatible with farming and ranching. I'm suggesting, as a working number, setting up 10 kilowatts of solar panels per person. So how much is that? That would be an array of about 20 feet by 30 feet, which would be installed, as I said, on a solar farm. Because the person is receiving money, not electricity, the panels can be installed anywhere. City dwellers could have their panels in the countryside. If they move, the money can follow them, even though the panels do not. The array size can be adjusted for the location. Sunny Arizona would need about 20% less, and cloudy Seattle maybe about 20% more. The cost of the panels these days is very reasonable. You can buy a 300-watt panel at Home Depot for $300, about $1 a watt, and less if you buy it in bulk. The racks, the wiring, the inverters, and the labor would be 2 to 3 times that, so the cost of a 10-kilowatt array would range from $30,000 to $40,000. A 10-kilowatt array in an average U.S. location, such as Indianapolis, would generate about 13,000 kilowatt hours per year. If the utility paid only 5 to 10 cents per kilowatt hour, that would amount to only $50 to $100 per month, which is not much of a basic income. So that's where I introduce the only controversial part of my program, where I propose that the utility would pay $1 per kilowatt hour for electricity generated specifically from solar for basic incomes, what I call solar dividends. That would produce $13,000 per year in revenue. And if $1,000 goes to overhead, that leaves $12,000 delivered in solar dividends to the individual, or about $1,000 a month, equivalent to Andrew Yang's freedom dividend.
Yeah, I want to come back to the dollar a kilowatt question, but
sure.
But I'm intrigued by the proposal to put the solar panels over agricultural areas, and you mentioned solar panels
semi-transparent solar panels.
Semi-transparent, yeah. which one of our physics professors here on campus has worked on.
Exactly.
Passing selective frequencies.
Yes, so, they're designed so that they're semi-transparent. The frequencies that they absorb are the frequencies needed by the electricity generation. The frequencies they pass through are the frequencies needed by the plant. So you can have them generating electricity, and the light that gets through still manages to grow the plants underneath. So you don't have a problem with compatibility between either or. You can do both.
You know, I know it's been tried with greenhouses. Has anything like this been tried out in the field?
No, not that I know of. The greenhouse application is the first obvious application because they already have a structure to put them on.
And what's the capacity factor of the greenhouses? You know, this is something I should have asked Sue Carter, and I can't remember now ever asking.
When you say capacity factor,
well,
you mean...
The efficiency. Okay.
These are definitely lower efficiency at this stage. They're still in development. But I shouldn't say that you can just go out right now and buy these and put them up on your field, because it's probably not something you could do because of the efficiency and the lifetime expectancy of them. They are something that is developing and could be in the future toolkit for this whole thing. You can do... other ways of doing agriculture is to put them on posts, pole-mounted systems with a tracker. And if you spread those out, then it doesn't block all the sunlight.
Yeah. We have to take a break, okay? You're listening to KSQD in Santa Cruz at 90.7 FM and KSQD.org on the web. Okay, I'm here speaking with Robert Staton about his new book, Solar Dividends, How Solar Energy Can Generate a Basic Income for Everyone on Earth. And we've been talking largely about, I think, more of the technical aspects so far. Now I want to just turn to the economics of this for a brief moment. So the proposal envisions electric utilities or distributors, I suppose it would be, paying $1 a kilowatt hour for electricity generated by these solar farms. And I read the book and I understand it, but I think our audience probably is wondering how you could get away with that.
Right, sure. It sounds a little shocking when you hear it for the first time, because most electricity costs in the range of 5 to 20, 25 cents per kilowatt hour. So a dollar kilowatt hour sounds pretty outrageous. But keep in mind that the solar dividend, solar farms, becomes only a part of this total electricity supply for the utility, along with many other sources. So I'm proposing that utility regulators require the utility to pay $1 per kilowatt hour only for electricity generated specifically for solar dividends from certified solar dividend farms. And they would do that for the combined social benefits of encouraging renewable energy to halt global warming, reducing poverty by providing basic incomes, and establishing a sustainable and clean energy system that won't run out. Those huge benefits justify the high price. This, of course, would lead to higher electricity prices, but not as high as you think. You won't see a dollar a kilowatt hour on your electric bill. The $1 cost to the utility is only for the part of the electricity supply from solar dividends. That gets rolled into the other sources that are cheaper. Your bill will actually reflect the average of all of the sources. At first, when only a few solar dividend farms are operating, there won't be much effect at all. As more farms are built and more of the electricity supply comes from that source, utility bills will gradually rise. If eventually, say, half the electricity supply costs $1 and half costs 12 cents to the utility, then the average cost on the consumer's bill would only be about 56 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, let's put that in perspective. PG&E's baseline rate is currently 22 cents per kilowatt hour, and it goes up to 49 cents if you use so much that you go into the third tier of pricing. So 56 cents doesn't sound that much higher than 49 cents. And of course, the higher prices will be easier to pay for because you are receiving $1,000 per month in basic income. The solar dividend income is much more than the increase in the electricity cost. Now, that might sound a little circular, but it works because only individuals are eligible for solar dividends, not businesses, governments, or organizations. So they help pay for the program through their utility bills. And as my book explains, higher energy prices are coming anyway. Our current low prices derive from abundant fossil fuels, whose full costs we simply do not pay. No one pays for global warming. So in a sense, we are cheating by paying low prices. We are foisting those high costs onto the next generations.
Let's take a couple of these points. I was just trying to do a quick calculation about how much electricity this, if at full rollout, how much electricity would be generated, and how does that compare to total energy consumption? I mean, a couple of things, right? We have to make the heroic assumption that we will actually considerably reduce our consumption of fossil fuels over the next 50 years, right? That's a basic requirement.
Yes.
In order to make renewables really practical, we have to engage in very intensive energy conservation.
Yes.
So I'm not quite sure, you know, there are all kinds of projections about energy use in 2050. Have you thought about that particular aspect? How much is going to be generated, and what fraction of total electricity or energy use is this going to comprise?
Well, I could run some numbers, but whatever numbers I run would be pretty speculative, of course.
Well.
my goal eventually would be to see 100 terawatts of solar power installed around the world. So I'm not just thinking in terms of the United States.
No,
I'm
I understand.
Thinking in terms of the entire world energy supply, because this is, of course, a global problem, our supply of energy. 100 terawatts would provide us with about 2 kilowatts per person on average. And that would be enough to supply all of our energy needs if we put in place extensive energy conservation, not just conservation, but efficiency improvements.
Yeah, of course.
Where we basically do the same project or do the same product, but use a lot less energy to do it. One of the other things that I see happening too is the reduction in the amount of throwaway goods, because throwaway goods are basically enabled by cheap energy. And as the price of energy goes up, they will decline, and we would have less throughput in our whole energy system. Our whole production system. Our landfills wouldn't need to handle so much junk that is used once and thrown away. So I think there are so many changes that are coming down that it's hard to say exactly how this will play out. The point, I think, is to establish the basic principles of the program, which is that solar energy has value. That value is spread all over the earth because solar energy is spread all over the earth. And because it is spread out, we can harvest that energy for the general good and for the allow everyone to have a piece of that economic pie, essentially.
So what fraction of that 100 terawatts, say, this is the other question, right? A dollar per kilowatt hour, but this is going to be balanced by other sources.
Right.
So what are these other sources, and how much of the total would that comprise?
Well, you're thinking. I actually figured 100 terawatts of solar PV and another 25 terawatts of other renewables, which would, I can think, consists primarily of wind, offshore wind, and hydro. I'm not a big fan of biofuels because I'm concerned about its use of land when we need to grow more food. But if there's a way to do it without consuming land, then I would be more in favor of it. But so you would end up with about 125 terawatts total for the energy system. And if you did 100 terawatts for every person on the planet, and estimating about 10 billion people, that's about 10 kilowatts per person. Now, I don't think we're going to reach every person with this program.
And that's total. That's not individual, right?
Yeah.
That should be clear about that. That encompasses all of the activities that go on.
All the activities, right. Whole economic system. That would be replacing all fossil fuels, nuclear, and with renewables. Yeah.
But 2 kilowatts is, is pretty good. I mean, that's certainly more than most people in the world get. And it's probably more than most of us need at any one particular time.
It's less than Americans get, but that's another story.
Well, yeah, but, look what we use it for.
Yeah.
What the inevitable question is, of course, what happens when the sun goes down?
Well, of course, part of the development of a 100% renewable energy system involves energy storage.
Okay.
And there's lots of research being done, lots of products already being developed. Batteries are one option, certainly, and the kind of lithium batteries that we have now for cars work really well, but there are better batteries if you just need to store electricity. For example, there's this thing called a flow battery, where instead of storing the electricity as charged plates inside of the battery, you put the electricity into the liquid part of the battery, and you flow that through the battery. And if you do it that way, then you can charge up the liquid, pull out the charged liquid and store it in a tank, and put in some fresh liquid. And by flowing the liquid through, you can have a battery as big as a tank that you can build, and tanks are cheap. So that would enable you to very easily store huge quantities of energy without the necessity of consuming all the lithium in the world.
When you first mentioned tank, I had, of course, in my mind, a military tank,
but you mean
a storage tank.
Yeah, liquid storage.
Military tanks aren't that cheap yet.
No. Another option is methanol.
But you were just saying about talking about biofuel. I mean, this would be
methanol is not a biofuel.
Okay,
methanol is another alcohol, but it's made by a chemical process without biological processes. You basically take water and carbon dioxide and run it through a series of steps and produce liquid methanol, which is a fuel that works in cars. If you want most of the cars that run at the Indy 500 actually run on methanol, and they do that because it's safer fuel than gasoline. So if there's a crash, it doesn't ignite the whole place. But it's well proven as a fuel, but it also can be used in a fuel cell, which is a device that converts fuel, some sort of fuel, into electricity directly. Most people are familiar with hydrogen fuel cells, which take hydrogen and convert it to electricity. But there are now methanol fuel cells. So you could run your methanol through such a device and generate electricity. So if you had a system set up where you convert your excess electricity on sunny and windy days to methanol, you could store that in tanks, storage tanks. And those tanks could be huge, just like the big oil tanks we have now. And then when you need the electricity, you feed it back through the fuel cells and generate the electricity on demand. Mm-hmm. I think in the long run, a big portion of our energy supply will be going through some sort of storage system because...
Well, it'll have to, right?
I mean, if you think about it, that's what fossil fuels do best. They store energy.
Right.
And they've
right.
stored it for millions of years. And what we're doing now is basically trying to recreate that part of the energy system using direct sunlight and wind.
Yeah, that's going to be pretty tricky, though, isn't it?
Well, it's not tricky, actually. It's just going to be add to the expense. And so,
well, we'll talk about politics in after the break. But
okay,
some of my questions are directed to that. Well, you're listening to KSQD. What, am I doing it okay? You're listening to KSQD, 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz, and KSQD.org on the web. You're listening to Sustainability Now, and my guest today is Robert Staton, who has just published a book called Solar Dividends, How Solar Energy Can Generate a Basic Income for Everyone on Earth. And we've been talking most recently about some of the logistics, the technical logistics, in particular, what do you do when the sun goes down if everything is solar, and how do you store the energy? And Bob was talking about methanol as one storage medium in addition to batteries. I mentioned a lot of this is kind of tricky, right? And of course, there are a number of technical aspects and features that would have to be worked out. The tricky part about it is that there's an existing infrastructure, right? When we start to think about sort of transitioning from the current energy infrastructure to this new one, right? It's fairly straightforward to think about the future. And certainly what we've got now, well, we've got now. But the problem is always how do you get from here to there? And this is something, I taught this past fall. I taught Thinking Green at UCSC, and I kept emphasizing, you know, it's great to have dreams, but you've got to figure out how to get there. So have you thought about that? You mentioned a great energy crisis in 2025, and a crisis is a wonderful way to mobilize people's minds and actions, right? But in another way, it's a trick. It's a writer's trick.
Right.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure. The nice thing about solar is that it can be introduced incrementally. We started very small, of course, when solar was very expensive and people put solar in and integrated in into and connected to the utility companies. And that works. What we're talking about is continuing that incremental process of introducing more and more renewable energy on a gradual basis. And the nice thing about things like photovoltaics and wind is they produce electricity, which is completely compatible with our current grid system.
Right.
So it can feed into the grid. And what's lacking is the ability to, as you say, provide it when the source isn't available, the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining. So that's where it needs to be combined in the utility system as part of an energy storage system. And that's already being done as well. There's a wind farm in Texas that when it was built, it built into itself an energy storage system. And they did that and it proved economic for them because they found that they could shift when they sell the electricity to when the prices were higher.
Right.
So the storage system worked out very well for them. So the energy storage is being put in place by utility companies as well because it helps them even out their own control of their system. It allows them to control the voltage and disperse the currents and all the other factors that they need to control better if they have this buffer that allows them to absorb and deploy energy on demand.
Do you envision utilities going over to direct current? or going ahead and converting to all. This is a bit of a technical point, right?
Yeah, it is.
but when you transform solar electricity, which is direct current, to alternating current, which is what we get out of our walls, you lose. You know, there's a certain efficiency loss to that, and often we convert the AC back to direct current for our televisions and all of our electronic gadgets. So I was just wondering. Right, this is an obscure, opaque technical point. I just wanted to ask you about it.
Well, there actually was a movie about DC versus AC recently.
Yeah,
you may
I saw
the
it too,
Tesla
right?
versus
yeah.
Westinghouse
was,
thing.
It was interesting. Yeah.
But in this case, we have an AC operating system infrastructure that we're going to keep for sure. All of the power lines, transformers, houses, appliances, and everything are set up for AC. We're not going to change that. What will come in from DC probably is primarily transmission lines, which is not something that the ordinary person has to encounter. They're putting in place higher voltage DC transmission lines to be able to transport electricity over greater distances. And one of the reasons they're doing that is particularly for wind farms, which are often in really windy places where nobody lives.
Yeah.
So they want to be able to transport the electricity from where it's available to where it can be used. And they also are looking in terms of sharing renewable energy across wider land areas so that when it's windy in one place and not in another, they can shuttle some of the energy from one place to another without having to store it if they do that kind of a sharing process.
My guest a couple of weeks ago was Dustin Mulvaney, who we talked about what do we do with the problem like PG&E. So the question of the distribution network came up.
Sure.
And of course, the distribution network is partly responsible for the fires, the wildfires of the last couple of years. And we had a conversation about sort of, you know, microgrids as a possible alternative. And it strikes me that your proposal in many ways lends itself to that kind of decentralized distribution system.
Yeah, I actually envision the utilities of the future as a more decentralized distribution system than as what their current role, which is building gigantic power plants in certain locations and then distributing the electricity over hundreds of square miles. The installation of solar can take place anywhere. Wind is often distributed in different places. And the utility's role in that case would be more of integrating all of these various sources to coordinate them and to distribute the energy and to provide the energy storage services. So eventually, and in any way, utilities like PG&E are getting out of the electricity generating business entirely and buying it from various third parties. So they are already on the path to becoming distribution and energy storage service companies instead of the source of all the electricity that they produce.
Right. That was a consequence largely of the so-called deregulation of the 1990s. I'm not sure the utilities were altogether happy about that.
No, probably not.
Because it sort of messed up their financial arrangements, you know. But
well, they had complete control over the entire electricity grid at one point, and they really liked that control, of course. But what this does is it would shift their role. They could still make money in the system by transporting energy and by storing it and charging for those services. It would just be a different model for them to adapt to.
Yeah. Well, do you have, I mean, can you think of any comparable situations in the recent past, you know, the past 100 years or so, that might resemble the kind of transition you're talking about? I think I just came up with an idea, but I want to hear from you because obviously there's a lot of politics involved in this. I mean, the energy system is fundamentally political.
Yes.
And if we haven't learned that, if I haven't learned that in 40 years of doing this stuff, you know, certainly I see that now. So in thinking, again, I want to sort of emphasize the transition. All right. I'm putting you on the spot here.
Right.
Right. And can you think of anything comparable?
Yeah, actually, something similar to what I'm proposing in terms of doing a lot of solar and doing it from the grassroots up was done in Germany, starting in 2000. Germany made the decision to provide incentives to build a solar energy industry.
Right.
And the way they did that was they put in place very high buyback rates for electricity generated from solar or wind. And that was all they did. They didn't have to mandate anything. They just said, we're going to pay more for solar electricity and put it out there. And the response was phenomenal. People looked at those rates and went, wow, I can make money on solar. And they started installing solar energy and connecting it up and getting payments. There was a great example of a dairy farmer who was struggling with his expenses of his dairy farm and put up an array of solar panels to supplement his income. And he thought that the arrangement was really great. And what it did was it drove Germany to become the leading installer of solar energy in the world. Mm-hmm. Over the course of a few years, it happened so fast that they actually had to cut back the program because they were getting too much solar energy and they weren't ready to handle it on the grid. So that was a case where setting the rate created an incentive that drove individuals to make the decision to pursue this. And that's something that I would like to see happen for solar dividends. The primary driver for it would be these high buyback rates. And if you put those in place and make it exclusively for solar dividends, then that would be enough of an incentive for co-ops to form because they would be guaranteed a rate and the banks would be willing to finance it because solar energy is very reliable over the long run.
Right.
So they would be guaranteed of a revenue stream to pay off the loans. And individuals would be motivated to join because if not for themselves, they would gain a benefit for their children or grandchildren. You could sign your child up for a 10 kilowatt array at birth. And then the money that would be used, generated by the system at first would be used to pay off the panels, say 3 or 4 or 5 years when the child is young. And then after it's paid off, the money could go into a solar escrow account until the child turns 18. And at 18, they gain control of that escrow account as a starting fund for their adult life. And then the income transfers over to becoming their monthly income, basic income delivered directly to their checking account. So with that kind of a system in place, I think you would see a public demand for it. That could overcome some of the resistance that the utilities and government would put in place to sort of slow this process down. That's my hope, anyway.
Yeah, well, now I'm going to be a politics professor. Okay. I mean, Germany, you know, Germany did this and the state, the government, really did take a lead on that. And I don't remember exactly the political configuration. It might have been a social during the Social Democrat Green coalition period. And of course, it proved very popular. We, of course, here, and we're, you know, thinking about the United States, are in a rather different situation. Although, you know, the state government, state of California, has pushed a lot on a lot of these issues. And so one could imagine this becoming, you know, gradually starting to penetrate the system.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be done at a national level by any means. It could be done at state level. It could be done at the level of a municipal utility, even.
Remember Upton Sinclair?
Yeah.
Right? That's he actually had a program like this. I can't remember what it was called, but when he ran for governor back in the 20s or 30s.
Oh, I don't remember that.
Yeah. Emily, our engineer, is looking it up, but there was something similar to that. Anyway,
well, because solar is distributed and it can be done at any scale, you can do this on a small scale or a large scale. You could do it at the national level. I think the politics in the U.S. are so polarized right now, though, it's difficult to see anything like this coming about in the near future. I could see it happening more in a state or a city. I also think that maybe the U.S. is going to be one of the last ones to do it and that Europe will lead in this program and make it happen sooner than the U.S.
You know, my philosophy at this point is that you really have to start with pilot examples and try and do it on a smaller scale.
Well, that's exactly what my book proposes.
Yeah,
I have a whole chapter on, in order to make this happen, this is a very new idea. Whenever I present this, people go, wow, that's very interesting, but I've never heard of this before. So I can't give examples of it working, of course.
No.
So, but that's what the goal of a pilot program would be to set it up in a way that we would have solar arrays installed, and they would generate electricity. The electricity would be sold into the grid, and the money would be used to pay for a basic income for a select group of people. And you would probably start it with low-income people, be selective in that regard, because that's where it would have the most impact. But of course, the utility is not going to sign on to that immediately and start paying a dollar a kilowatt hour unless they're being very generous or if they're forced to by the state. But you could simulate it in a pilot program by having another source of funding so that it would look like it's coming from the utility, but it's actually being transferred via blockchain or some other payment process to make it look like it's coming in as the payment for the solar dividends from the utility company. The point would be to study the effect on the people who are receiving the money and to study how much solar is installed and what kind of incentive this would create in the public for seeing these kinds of programs put in place. And I think once the public, once these programs are studied and the benefits are documented, that would give ammunition to advocates and to sympathetic politicians to try an actual pilot program with a utility company, basically asking the regulatory body to set the rate for a small scale and see how it actually works in real life.
Yeah, here, there's a proposal for the California Energy Commission. Emily just looked up Upton Sinclair. His program was called End Poverty in California, or EPIC. And it was essentially a Keynesian public works program, much like the federal government was doing. He ran for governor in 1934. So it wasn't a guaranteed wage, no, but it was certainly a full employment program. And by the way, he wrote The Jungle. So and I always confuse Upton Sinclair and Sinclair Lewis.
All right.
But no matter. Okay, I'm going to take the short break. You're listening to KSQD in Santa Cruz at 90.7 FM. And ksqd.org online. Let's see. Let's try. I'm still sort of interested. Well, I thought about two major transitions, right, in our sort of ways of life, let's call it, in our social systems. The first one was from horses to cars, right, which of course relied on the rise of the petroleum industry. But it was not really sort of set and trained by the state, right? It was very much, I think, a market-produced sort of process, and highways came later, paved highways came later. On the other hand, the breakup of AT&T in the 1980s was an antitrust movement, right? And then they started the beginning to auction off the microwave spectrum for cell phones was also a state initiative. And now, of course, we've got cell phone monopolies, but we have a very different kind of phone system. Instead of, you know, landlines only and the black basic phone, we've got all kinds of things and smartphones. And that certainly has had a major impact on the way that people communicate with each other, whether it's for good or better or worse. As a troglodyte, I'm less sure. But you know, this is the kind of sort of the visioning that I think is really important.
Well, that was actually part of the motivation for the deregulation of energy in California was the result from the phone company breakup. They wanted to do the same thing, make the energy industry more competitive by breaking up the big monopoly utilities and forcing them to allow other generators to participate in the system. And of course, it led to great abuses. The Enron scandal was the classic case where the whole system was totally abused and it didn't work out quite well for the customers at all. But it did have the effect of noting that utility companies do have a monopoly, essentially. And it's a natural monopoly because we don't want competing utility lines spread all over the place. But we do want to be able to have other participants in the program. And so part of because electricity is regulated by the state, there are opportunities for that regulation to include other parties, and solar dividends could fit into that regulation scheme.
of course, utilities aren't natural monopolies anymore. I mean, they own the distribution system, right? But right here in Santa Cruz, we've got Monterey Bay Community Power, which is selling electricity. It's buying it somewhere and selling it. So you know, maybe there's a first step.
There are definitely opportunities, I think. It's a matter of knowing where to start first.
So, you know, of course, one of the big questions is how this might happen in the global south.
Well, this idea is highly adaptable, I think, to local conditions. I have an example in the book of how a program might work in Kenya, for example. Consider a village without electricity and little cash. They would not seem to be a good candidate for this because they couldn't buy the electricity. So instead, you could install a solar farm near a city like Nairobi, where reliable electricity is in demand and high rates can be afforded. Keep in mind that it's only the money that needs to be transferred to the village. Once the money starts flowing into the village from the solar dividends, the people who live there could afford to set up their own solar panels and buy things like electric pumps, refrigerators, and lights to upgrade their lives. And eventually bring that huge portion. There's about a billion people in the world that don't have electricity now. Right. That could eventually be brought into getting energy services and upgrading their lives through that process.
But, you know, I can sort of see here in the United States working out the arrangements for a dollar a kilowatt hour. But the money would have to come from somewhere.
Yeah. When you say the money would have to come from somewhere, it comes from utility bills. And so that's what happens, is that dollar kilowatt hour gets folded into utility bills, and everyone who buys electricity pays into it.
No, I'm thinking about in places like Kenya.
Well, in cities where they have electricity, they use electricity and they pay utility bills.
So is there anything I have left out, you know, as is often the case? How about transportation and industry? I know you mentioned that in the book, and we haven't really talked about that. Transportation in particular, what is...
Well, there's a whole... the whole idea here is to eventually, as part of the benefits of solar dividends, is to generate a lot of solar electricity to replace fossil fuels, with the goal eventually of eliminating fossil fuels. So you have to examine every energy use of fossil fuels that takes place now and figure out how you're going to substitute something for it. Mm-hmm. Transportation is already happening because electric cars are becoming more and more popular. Mm-hmm. Some of the car companies are actually talking about making only electric cars, which I'm a little surprised at this point, but they have an optimistic future for electric cars. And UPS is just about to buy a bunch of electric delivery vehicles, for example. So it's scaling up. Of course, in Europe, electric trains have been around for decades. Mm-hmm. There are certain cases of transportation that are a little more difficult to convert, for example, airplane travel, although there are currently electric airplanes being tested for short flights, commercial flights. But long term, it's unlikely we will have electric planes traveling across the Atlantic. But one thing that solar energy is nothing but versatile. And you can actually take some of that methanol, for example, and run it through a couple more processes and generate aviation fuel out of it. So theoretically, you could produce airplane flight with solar energy. Whether or not it would be cost effective and people could afford to fly it is another question, but that depends on how the technology plays out. But it is possible to do it. So there's a lot of industry that currently can convert. For example, the mining industry is already in the process of trying to convert to renewable energies. There's a copper mine in Chile that is scheduled to go 100% renewable next year. And a lot of the big mining trucks that are rolling around transporting the materials in mines actually have electric motors on their wheels. They have an electric motor on each of the wheels that gives them a high degree of maneuverability and a high degree of torque to get started. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But currently they have a generator on board to generate the electricity to drive those wheels. So if instead you had batteries or fuel cells on board, you could run those trucks now on solar electricity.
That's actually how a lot of the trains in the high-speed trains in Europe get their electricity, now that I think about it.
Okay.
There are trains with overhead lines, but they actually have diesel generators to generate the electricity.
Right.
Because I remember getting stuck in the Channel Tunnel during one very cold winter.
Oh my!
When I think it was that the diesel generators or something froze up.
Oh God!
It was a real snafu. Yeah. But I understand that. Well, I'm just looking here. What have we not talked about? Or maybe you have some things you want to bring up.
One of the things I want to emphasize is there's a very strong social justice component to this program.
Yeah.
Fossil fuels are unevenly distributed around the world, leading to great concentrated wealth. Think of the king and princes in Saudi Arabia, for example, or the few countries that have solar wealth, and how it almost always goes to a few individuals, the oligarchs within the country. And that wealth never seems to get down to all the people that should benefit from it. But with solar, no one owns the sun. No one owns the energy flowing off the surface of the sun. No one owns the energy as it passes through the atmosphere. There is really no fundamental reason why this energy cannot be shared among all people. We could even establish solar energy as a human right, a right to a share of our planet's primary energy source. And if we do share it, then we can eliminate poverty. Everyone gets a share of the economic pie because energy is the one commodity that every economy must have to function. So sharing the energy system gets everyone in on the ground floor of the economy. And because solar energy doesn't run out, it's good for their whole life.
There was a big debate about water as a human right some years ago, with the water companies saying, "Well, no, you can't. That's not going to work because
Well, the difference is that water is already owned by people, and you're dealing with existing rights. Whereas solar energy, who owns the sun? Nobody.
Not yet. Well, you know, I am sure there are ingenious lawyers, patent lawyers out there, who are trying to figure out how to do that, since
we're proposing
to privatize the atmosphere with carbon emission permits and cap and trade.
That's true.
Right?
Right.
And, you know, I wouldn't doubt that, but declaring the sun a commons, you know, strikes me as another sort of politically attractive move, right? I think that would be a good piece of the campaign.
One nice thing about it is that you're not taking away anything from someone because nobody owns it now. You are basically declaring a source that's already available to everyone as guaranteed to be available to them.
So. I'm going to reveal myself here. Capitalism is about taking things from other people.
Sure.
Right. And so, I wouldn't begin to make claims. So that's where the politics comes in,
sure.
Right? And making sure that nobody tries to do that.
Right.
But that's a particular sort of bugaboo, I guess that's the word of mine.
You know, sometimes I'm not sure that the world is ready for this idea. But I think unless we put forth positive visions of how the world can be, we won't ever get there. So if I could read a short Bucky Fuller quote.
Sure.
You never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete.
Well, that was Buckminster Fuller, and I'm going to invoke Ursula Le Guin, who basically did a piece on it. It was California as a cold place to be, and I can't remember the full title, but it's a wonderful essay in which she addresses the question of utopia. And says, basically, you know, you can't come at utopia full on. You have to kind of sidle towards it. And this is basically that, again, models can be created, but the real trick is how do you put it into operation?
Well, one of the things that I'm hoping is to do this kind of under the radar, because this can be done without a government making a law that permits it. You do have to eventually get the government involved through the utility regulation process.
Right.
But you could start the process now with people installing solar and distributing the money as it is. So I think it's possible to adapt this to a lot of different ways. And in the long run, I think it will prove its value. And hopefully enough people will want to sign on to do it.
Have you pitched this to anyone in Sacramento?
Not yet. I have a whole list of people I need to contact about this. Part of the problem is getting through to them. Actually, I did send something to the head of the natural resources, but I didn't hear back.
Yeah, that's not the place to go, right. But we can talk about that later.
Right.
Okay. We have 3 minutes left. And anything else that you have in there, Bob, that you want to?
Well, let's see here.
Well.
No. Sorry.
No matter. Well, listen, we've been talking to Bob Staton, whose recent book, Solar Dividends, was just published. And he makes what many people would say is a radical proposition. But actually, if you start to think it through, maybe it's not so radical as it appears. And I think your target date is at the end of the century, right? So we do have some
time. 50 years or so,
if we get to the end of the century, yeah. We have time to put this into operation.
No, we need to start now to get it by the end of the century.
And I'm going to go home and start thinking about the politics of this and how you could start to pitch it. I'm not allowed to do that on the radio, right?
Well, one of the things I'm hoping is to engage a lot more people in this, because I don't want to feel like I'm the only one that has this idea.
Sure.
And I want to stimulate other people thinking about it and contributing to how it can go. So I have a website, solardividends.org. If you want to take a look at that, hopefully get engaged.
Okay. Well, thank you. So,
in 2 weeks, my guest on Sustainability Now will be Maya Ellison, Executive Director of Co-Renewal. Maya is a teacher, naturalist, mycologist, organizer, and lover of the wild, dedicated to enacting effective and just solutions to environmental and social crises by working in collaboration with fungi. Co-Renewal is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing education and research in ecosystem restoration, health, and healing, and sustainable community dynamics through community development and bioremediation, the nature-based solution to human-caused pollution. That's on Sustainability Now, Sunday, August 22nd, 2021, from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on KSQD 90.7 FM and ksquid.org, streaming on the internet. Thanks for listening, and thanks to all the staff and volunteers who make KSQD your community radio station, including Emily Dunham, who is engineer for this show. And so, until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.